So this evening, given the season, I thought I'd talk about joy. It seemed like a good seasonal topic. And I'm going to base this whole talk on this book called The Book of Joy, which is a series of dialogues between His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was the Archbishop of South Africa during apartheid and afterwards. And it's a wonderful book. If you haven't actually got a copy of this book and haven't read it yet, I highly recommend it, or give it to people for Christmas or something, because it makes me happy every time I read it. So I thought I'd share some tidbits of it here. And in particular, I want to focus on what they call the eight pillars of joy. So most of the book up until this point, they've been having these dialogue about various topics, and then they figured out, they were together for a week in Dharamsala, that here were these eight pillars. Pillars, think that this is what holds up joy, okay? And which one, read directly here. As our dialogue progressed, we converged on eight pillars of joy. Four were qualities of the mind: perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. And four were qualities of the heart: forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity. The thing that strikes me about this list more than anything else is nothing, there's nothing that says here, and I get joy by getting more stuff or getting cool stuff. It has nothing to do with any of that at all. It has to do with our heart mind, how we interact in the world, how we view the world. So, the first of these is perspective. I also have a huge number of other books here I want to read little tiny tidbits from. So, this is about perspective. And this is a little book called This Is Water by David Foster Wallace. I'm sure some of you have heard me read from this before. It's the text of a commencement commencement speech he gave. There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys. How's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit. Then eventually, one of them looks at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" This is perspective. It's understanding context, right? What is water? Yeah. So, move on here. So this is when they talk about perspective. You might. It's like this is perspective in what in the Buddhist terms is sometimes called right view, are very similar in how they talk about them and are almost synonymous. The Dalai Lama used the terms wider perspective and larger perspective. They involve stepping back within our own mind to look at the bigger picture and to move beyond our limited self-awareness and our limited self-interest. Every situation we confront in life comes with from a con the convergence of many contributing factors. The Dalai Lama had explained, "We must look at any given situation or problem from the front and from the back, from the sides, and from the top and the bottom, so from at least eight different angles. This allows us to take a more complete and holistic view of reality. And if we do, our response will be more constructive." We suffer from perspectival myopia. I love that phrase. As a result, we are left nearsighted, unable to see our experience in a larger way. When we confront a challenge, we often react to the situation with fear and anger. The stress can make it hard for us to step back and see other perspectives and other solutions. This is natural, the Archbishop emphasized throughout the week. But if we try, we can become less fixated or attached to use the Buddhist terms, to one outcome and can use more skillful means to handle the situation. We see that in the most seemingly limiting circumstances, we have choice and freedom, even if that freedom is ultimately the attitude we will take. How can a trauma lead to growth and transformation? How can a negative event become positive? We are being invited to see the blessing in the curse and the joy in the sorrow. And this is like having the right attitude. Just having the right attitude towards things, instead of going, oh my God, it's so horrible, which is not the sort of the opposite of joy, right? So just having the right perspective, let the joy creep into the situation. And we start to see that there is joy there as well, that it's not all black, you know, that it's an interesting combination of things. I also want to read something from the Sutta here. This is from Samaditti Sutta, from the Majjhima Nikaya. The Sutta on View. What a surprise, right? And here he's talking about how to have right view, wholesome view, about the Four Noble Truths, where all the Buddhist teachings end up coming from that place. Good friends, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple, understanding suffering, the origin of suffering, the sensation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, in that way he is one of right view, and he has arrived at the true Dhamma. And what is suffering? What is the origin of suffering? What is the cessation of suffering? What is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? Birth is suffering. If you have a body, suffering is built in. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to obtain what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. This is called suffering. And what is the origin of suffering? It is craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being. This is called the origin of suffering. And what is the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of craving. And what is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is just this noble eightfold path. This steps of the eightfold path. This is called the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And when a noble disciple has thus understood suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, he here and now makes an end to suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So this is a continuing theme. If we're going to have perspective, we need to look at things. We have to have the perspective is based on the Four Noble Truths. That's what we have to always come back to, that as our sort of the container of our view, in a sense. It's interesting, you know, the very first time the Buddha taught, what he taught was the Four Noble Truths. And then there is in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions on meditation, and what's the last thing that we have to be able to contemplate and understand? Four Noble Truths. The beginning and the end. It's all there. It's like, and everything else the Buddha taught was just trying to get people to understand the Four Noble Truths, essentially. For 40 years, he tried to get people to pay attention and understand. But that's what all of the teachings of the Buddha are about. So, anyhow, so that's the first of these, what they call the mental perspective. Then we have humility. It's an interesting one. This is, once again, a mental attitude. It's how we approach the world, right? The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were both insistent that humility is essential to any possibility of joy. I fascinated that they tied those two together. When we have a wider perspective, we have a natural understanding of our place in the great sweep of all that was, is, and will be. This naturally leads to humility and the recognition that as human beings we can't solve everything or control all aspects of life. We need others. The Archbishop has poignantly said that our vulnerabilities, our frailties, and our limitations are a reminder that we need one another. We are not created for independence or self-sufficiency, but for interdependence and mutual support. The Dalai Lama was saying that we are all born and all die in the same way, and at these moments we are totally dependent on others, whether we are the Dalai Lama or a beggar, whether we're an archbishop or a refugee. It's like, and notice how the first of these, this wider perspective, led directly to humility. Like these aren't like the eight pillars, but they're all pillars of a building, all work together, right? They're interrelated. And the other aspect of this that I wanted to mention is, you know, when the Buddha talked, there's this really famous quote. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. When anyone, on the basis of form, which is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, regards themselves thus, I am superior, or I am inferior, or I am equal, what does that do apart from not seeing things as they really are? This is called in Buddhist terminology, it's called conceit, which means more than what we, you know, our normal usage of English language, conceit. It basically means comparing. If we compare ourselves to other people, then we inevitably suffer. We inevitably cause our own suffering, and we take away any chance of joy, because either we're like, oh, you know, I'm so much better than all those other people, yeah, or they're all those people are so much better than me, or even we're all the same. In all those cases, what we're doing every time is creating a sense of me, not me. I'm comparing my me to someone else, so it creates a sense of self and a sense of other. No matter how, whether you think you're better than, you think you're worse than, you think you're equal to, you're always comparing, in that process, creating a sense of a separate self. And it seems so natural. It seems like, well, of course, we always are comparing ourselves to other people. And it's a great cause of suffering, and it takes away joy. It takes away the opportunity for joy to arise, you know, no matter what you do. I want to tell you a little story about this, actually. This is I was on a retreat. This is one of my long retreats. And I was getting fairly deep into the practice at this point. So this must have been like my fourth or fifth long retreat. And I got to the point where the teacher I was working with was giving me very personal instructions on a particular thing to do in practice. And he wrote it all down on a little sticky note. He said, you know, keep this next to you on your mat or your chair or whatever. And if if this is happening, then make sure you remember. This is going to help you remember. I got the special instruction. I was like, feeling pretty good. And so I go and I'm sitting, and then I look around the room at some point, later in the day or something, and there's this person, oh, three or four spots over me. She's got a sticky note too. We must both be really special. It's like, oh, really? This is great. And then the next day, I'm just trying to follow these instructions and working with them and struggling with them. But it was like, still feeling pretty good about myself. I look over, and now that woman has two sticky notes, and I only have one. So now all of a sudden, oh my God, now I mean that she's better than me, like, and it's just like, it was so easy to fall into that space of comparing myself to this other person who I didn't know, and she could have had chicken soup recipes on her sticky notes for all I know. I mean, I was pretty sure, because she was interviewing with guys like I was, that she probably had similar things to what I was working with. But it was just like, it was so easy to get caught up in the comparing mind. Just like that. Just, oh wait, she's got two sticky notes and I only have one. Just, we have to think, which leads me to the next of these. And the third of these mental qualities is humor. So essential to this practice. Being able to laugh at ourselves, even as we're caught in old, familiar, unwholesome patterns. Like, there we are caught, and it's like, oh God, this one again. And have a little giggle. And it just takes the power away from whatever's arising at that time. If you just can sort of let it be, it's kind of silly. Of course, things to say here as well. And this is once again from this Book of Joy. Once we can see life in its wider perspective, and once we are able to see our role in this drama with some degree of humility, now here we are building, right? And once we are able to laugh at ourselves, then we can sort of have a sense of humor. And then that leads us directly to the fourth of these, which is acceptance, which is like, yeah, it's okay. Once we can see life in its wider perspective, once we're able to see our role in its drama with some degree of humility, and once we're able to laugh at ourselves, then we can come to the fourth and final quality of mind, which is the ability to accept our life in all its pain, imperfection, and beauty. I talk about this a lot, and I think this is just like the idea that no matter what's there, no matter what's arising at the level of mind or body, at some level we have to be able to go, that's okay. We have to accept it. This is what I got right now. We may not like it. In fact, it might be really unpleasant. But if we struggle against it, we just make things worse. We have to learn to, and I'm not saying we sort of toss up our hands and go, oh, nothing I can do about this either. Acceptance doesn't mean that. Acceptance means look at what's there and be real. Be honest with yourself, with the reality of the situation. Acceptance, it must be pointed out, is the opposite of resignation and defeat. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama are two of the most tireless activists for creating a better world for all its inhabitants. But their activism comes from deep acceptance of what is. The Archbishop did not accept the inevitability of apartheid, but he did accept its reality. We are meant to live in joy, the Archbishop explained. This does not mean that life will be easy or painless. It means that we can turn our face to the wind and accept that this is the storm we must pass through. We cannot succeed by denying what exists. The acceptance of reality is the only place from which we can begin. The Archbishop has said that when one grows in the spiritual life, you are able to accept anything that happens to you. You accept the inevitable frustrations and hardships as part of the warp and woof of life. And then a bit further on here. So many of the causes of suffering come from our reacting to the people, places, things, and circumstances in our lives rather than accepting them. When we react, we stay locked in judgment and criticism, anxiety and despair, even denial and addiction. It is impossible to experience joy when we are stuck this way. Acceptance is the sword that cuts through all of this resistance, allowing us to react, to see clearly, and to respond appropriately. Further on, the kind of acceptance that the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were advocating is not passive. It is powerful. It does not deny the importance of taking life seriously and working hard to change what needs changing, to redeem what needs redemption. You must not hate those who do harmful things, the Dalai Lama has explained. The compassionate thing is to do what you can to stop them, for they are harming themselves as well as those who suffer from their actions. One of the key paradoxes in Buddhism is that we need goals to be inspired, to grow and to develop, even to become enlightened. But at the same time, we must not get overly fixated or attached to these aspirations. If the goal is noble, your commitment to the goal should not be contingent on your ability to attain it. And in pursuit of our goal, we must release our rigid assumptions about how we must achieve it. Peace and equanimity come from letting go of our attachment to the goal and the method. This is the essence of acceptance. This is a real sticky one. For me, it has been off and on all my practice life. It's like we get this idea of like, this is how it's supposed to be, this is where I'm supposed to end up, this is what's supposed to happen. And then we get caught in wanting that instead of accepting, well, this is what's happening. If we can just let go and accept what's happening, then there's the joy can be there. If we're always striving and trying to get something that isn't there yet, it's never a happy time. It's the opposite of joy. And we have to find that whatever is arising in our practice right now, in this moment, in this week, in this year, whatever, on this retreat, whatever's arising, That's what's there now. And we just accept that's what's there now. That's, in some ways, the hardest part of this practice. That sense of acceptance, of being okay with what is, and not thinking it should be or it has to be some other amazing thing. So those are the four, what they call the mental mind parts. Perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. And notice how they all build. Perspective gives us, makes us into a place where we can see how we're just part of a much larger thing, which gives us humility. Then we can laugh at ourselves when we keep thinking we're not. And then we have to go, and that's okay. We have to accept it for what it is. Because all of these things are holding up the possibility of joy being there. And then Then we have these, the other four. And this is, first of these is forgiveness. This is a huge topic for both the Dalai Lama and for Desmond Tutu, because they were treated really horribly in their lives. Apartheid, which Tutu is like suffered from for years and years and years, and the Dalai Lama got thrown out of his country, literally thrown out of Dharamsala, out of Tibet, and had to settle in North India instead. And both of them have the most sort of forgiving hearts you can imagine. They talk about it in a really wonderful way. I'm going to talk about this in two sections here. Forgiveness, the Archbishop added, is the only way to heal ourselves and to be free from the past. Wow, the only way to heal ourselves and be free from the past. And that's, as he explained, without forgiveness, we remain tethered to the person who harmed us. We are bound to the chains of bitterness, tied together, trapped. Until we can forgive the person who harmed us, that person will hold the keys to our happiness. That person will be our jailer. When we forgive, then we take back control of our own fate and our own feelings. We become our own liberators. And we have to understand that forgiveness doesn't mean you're saying whatever happened back there is okay. We're not saying that at all. We're just saying, I'm tired. I'm really tired of all this negative emotional energy around this person that I keep experiencing over and over and over and over again when I keep telling myself those same old stories. And once you forgive the person, you're basically just saying, I don't want to be chained to you anymore. I don't want you to have that level of control of my life and my heart. That's all we're saying. It isn't saying we like them or we love them. We're just saying we forgive them. Because it's the only way out. The only way to break the chains. Not easy. I'm not for 1 second saying it's easy. The book goes on. We can also realize that obviously nobody was born to be cruel, to harm us, but because of certain circumstances, now he or she dislikes me, she hits me. Perhaps my behavior or attitude or even my facial expression contributed to this person becoming my enemy. So I was also involved. Who is to blame? So sitting and thinking of the different causes and conditions, when you see that if we are really angry, we must be angry towards the causes and conditions. Ultimately, their anger, their ignorance, their short-sightedness, their narrow-mindedness. So that brings a sense of concern, and we feel sorry for these people. So it was totally wrong, he said, cutting his hand sharply through the air, to say that the practice of tolerance and the practice of forgiveness are signs of weakness. Totally wrong. 100% wrong. 1000% wrong. Forgiveness is a sign of strength, isn't it? The Dalai Lama said, turning to the Archbishop. Absolutely yes, the Archbishop said with a laugh. I was just going to say that those who are forgiving is a sign of weakness, haven't tried it. Those who say that forgiving is a sign of weakness haven't tried it. I love that. When we think of forgiveness, I've given a whole talk, Dharma talks just on forgiveness. I just want to mention one thing about this practice, because it is a practice. This is a real serious practice, actually. That there are three forms, three layers of forgiveness. asking other people for forgiveness, whether it's just on the mental level or actually physically asking them for forgiveness, forgiving others, and forgiving ourselves, which is often the hard one. But it's like we have to be able to have forgiveness on all three of those levels for it to be complete. And some of us need probably lean more towards one or the other of those, depending on what's going on in our lives, how or what our mental makeup is, and who knows. But we have to be able to be really clear that all three of those are necessary. Asking forgiveness, forgiving others, forgiving ourselves. Then we move on. The next of these is gratitude. I want to start with a little quote. The Buddha said that there are two things that are remarkably rare in this world: people who benefit others and people who feel gratitude. Isn't that an amazing statement? These people are remarkably rare in the world: people who benefit others and people who feel gratitude. I want to see what the book has to say. Neither the Archbishop nor the Dalai Lama spent a great deal of time talking about enjoyment, perhaps because both of their traditions are skeptical of finding lasting happiness through sensual indulgence. But I've been happy to find that neither of them was opposed to pleasures permitted in their spiritual lives, whether Tibetan rice pudding or rum raisin ice cream. Gratitude is the elevation of enjoyment. Gratitude is the elevation of enjoyment, the ennobling of enjoyment. Gratitude is the recognition of all that holds us in this, the web of life, and all that has been made possible to have the life that we have and the moment that we are experiencing. Thanksgiving is a natural response to life and may be the only way to savor it. Both Christian and Buddhist traditions, perhaps all spiritual traditions, recognize the importance of gratefulness. It allows us to shift our perspective, as the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop counseled, towards all we have been given and all that we have. It moves us away from the narrow-minded focus on fault and lack into the wider perspective of benefit and abundance. The Dalai Lama's ability to be grateful for the opportunities that exist even in exile was a profound shift in perspective, allowing him not only to accept the reality of his circumstances, but also to see the opportunity in every experience. Acceptance does not mean fighting reality. I can repeat that. Acceptance does not mean fighting reality. Gratitude means embracing reality. It means moving from counting your burdens to counting your blessings, as the Archbishop had recommended, both as an antidote to envy and a recipe for appreciating our own lives. I wanted to also share something. This is from one of Jack Kornfield's books. Now, this is an actual gratitude exercise. So, if you want to close your eyes as I read this, you can, or if you want to just sort of take it in, however it suits you. But this is, he's actually very precisely saying, look at all we have to be grateful for, and reminding us. With gratitude, I remember the people, animals, plants, insects, creatures of the sky and the sea, air, water, fire, and earth, all those whose joyful exertion blesses my life every day. With gratitude, I remember the care and labor of 1,000 generations of elders and ancestors who came before me. I offer my gratitude for the safety and well-being I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the blessing of this earth that I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the measure of health I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the family and friends that I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the community I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the teachings and lessons I have been given. I offer my gratitude for the life I have been given. Just that, to be grateful for having a life in the first place. The book's called The Wise Heart. That particular section struck me as very wise. Next one is compassion. First of all, I'm going to read a dictionary definition. Compassion is a feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another who is stricken by misfortune, accompanied by a strong desire to alleviate suffering. So this is the difference between compassion and empathy. Empathy, you can experience, you feel the suffering of others. But compassion has this added thing of a strong desire to alleviate the suffering. It has an active piece to it. It's not just taking things in. It's like, now what can I do? And maybe sometimes all you can do is smile at the person. Hold their hand. Whatever. But it's what can we do? In the Theravada world, compassion arises in a mind full of loving kindness when it encounters suffering in the world. It's sort of the definition of compassion in the Theravada world. Just heart is full of loving kindness, encounters suffering, compassion just naturally arises. Let's see what these guys have to say here. This is an important point. While everyone agrees that being compassionate is a worthy goal, it is hard for many people to understand or put into practice. The word compassion, as we have said, literally means suffering with. So what would you say to the person who says, I have enough problems on my own. Why should I worry about being more compassionate and think about others who are suffering? As we have discussed, the Dalai Lama began, we are social animals. Even for kings or queens or spiritual leaders, their survival depends on the rest of the community. So therefore, if you want a happy life and fewer problems, you have to develop a serious concern for the well-being of others. So when someone is passing through a difficult period or difficult circumstances, then automatically will come a sense of concern for their well-being. And if there's a possibility for help, then you can help. If there's no possibility to help, you can pray or wish them well. Even that simple thought. So the truth is, our usual reaction when we see suffering is to turn away, because it's unpleasant. We want to avoid the unpleasantness we experience when we encounter someone who's suffering. We don't want to experience the unpleasantness. We'd rather distract ourselves with something pleasant. This is the human nature, our habit patterns. This aversion takes different forms, including fear and denial that the suffering actually exists or that it's their fault. If we don't turn away, we often get angry. It's like we get into what we'll call, let's say, righteous anger. It's like, that suffering is being caused by those people or that person or that situation or that government. And we get into this whole righteous anger thing. You see this about the whole situation in Gaza. I've seen it over and over and over again. You see people who are caught up in righteous anger. It's horrible what's happening there, and it's still happening there. But being caught up in righteous anger doesn't do anything for the people there, number one. And number two, just causes more suffering in the world. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do whatever we can to fix that situation, do whatever we can to help in whatever way seems relevant to you. But righteous anger just gets in the way. Another bit of Jack Kornfield. This is from his book called The Path of Heart. He's talking about being compassionate and what that means. No one says this will be easy. Sitting in meditation is difficult, and acting in meditation is equally difficult. It may take years of practice to learn how to enter the family arena or the political arena and stay connected with our deepest compassion. Staying connected takes a particular unconscious effort. Yet what is sacred and what is true is found here as much as anywhere. We may be confused initially because our world is complex. When we sit alone, we face only our own suffering. When we act in our families or in the world community, we must also face the suffering that connects all us with all of life. Hundreds and millions of our brothers and sisters live in situations of great injustice and great poverty. At times, the injustice and sorrow of all that if it all seems overwhelming, beyond our capacity to face. It's something in us knows that this too is part of spiritual life, and that we can respond to this suffering as part of our own, which in fact it is. None of us can avoid tyranny, loss, sorrow, or death. We are all interconnected in the destruction or saving of our planet. We must remember that the world's current problems are fundamentally a spiritual crisis created by the limited vision of human beings, a loss of a sense of connection to one another, a loss of community, and most deeply, a loss of connection to our spiritual values. This is written 25 years ago. Could be written yesterday. Could be written 500 years ago, probably too. It's like the human condition. And it brings out that sense that we have to work on our compassion, our ability to be compassionate. One other little note about compassion. It is said of the Buddha, the Blessed One is compassionate and seeks our welfare. He teaches the Dhamma out of compassion. That's why the Buddha taught. I mean, basically, he became enlightened. And there's a whole long sutta about this, but he basically said, oh God, no one will ever understand this stuff. I'm just going to go, sit in the forest for the rest of my life. And then, of course, in this tradition, a deva came and convinced him that there were those in the world who had little dust in their eyes, and that he should have to deal with all the pain and agony and grief of having a sangha and teaching, so that those with little dust in their eyes could reach what he has reached. And then he spent 40 years of his life teaching. In incredibly difficult circumstances sometimes. Like people tried to kill him. People were always dissing him. People were trying to steal his disciples and arguing and causing trouble. And he just kept on out of a sense of compassion. did what he could. Okay. Then the last of these, generosity. All right, so I have one more thing from the Book of Joy here, and then I have other things to read as well. These guys have a real sense of humor sometimes. I've sometimes joked that God doesn't know very much about math, because when you give to others, it should be that you are subtracting from yourself. But in this incredible kind of way, I've certainly found that to be the case so many times. You gave, and it seems like, in fact, you are making space for more to be given to you. And this is a mere physical example. The Dead Sea in the Middle East receives fresh water, but it has no outlet, so it doesn't pass the water out. It receives beautiful water from the rivers and water, and the water goes dank. I mean, it goes bad. And that's why it's the Dead Sea. It receives and it does not give. And we are made much the same way too. I mean, we receive and we must give. In the end, generosity is the best way of becoming more and more joyful. Isn't that a great idea? Generosity is a way to become more and more joyful. I want to read a few things from Joseph here. We may not yet know the happiness of full enlightenment, but all along the path we do experience clear times of non-sensual joy, the unworldly pleasant feelings. We experience them in times of generosity, when we are renouncing mind states of greed and stinginess. Think of times when you were generous with someone, giving something out of love or compassion, respect or gratitude. Practicing generosity is an easily accessible gateway to the happy, unworldly feelings based on renunciation. And it is the reason the Buddha usually begins his progressive teachings speaking of generosity. This is true. Every time the Buddha went to a new place, because he was a wandering monk, right? Every time he came to a new village, the first thing he always taught was generosity. Because anyone, no matter their ability, their intelligence, their age, their whatever, everyone can practice generosity. It's a universal practice. Everybody is capable. No special qualifications required other than an open heart. And this is, he's talking about the power of reflecting on generosity. Not only so should we be generous, we should reflect on it. Another reflection that brings joy and rapture to the mind is remembering and delighting in our acts of generosity. Sometimes this is not easy for Westerners to do, because we might confuse this wholesome recollection with pride or conceit. But just as it is possible to have a feeling of loving appreciation for the generosity of others, we can have the same feeling for our own generous actions. One striking example of this happens regularly at some of the meditation monasteries in Asia. Lay people will often come to the monasteries to offer food to the meditators, and then sit in the dining hall as the yogis are eating, delighting in the offering. People will just sit there and watch the monastics eat and be like thrilled that the monastics are eating their food. And they're not eating. They don't eat till after the monastics eat all they want. As an experiment, think back to over particular generous acts you've done. Remembering the initial thought of giving, how you felt in the moment of the offering, and the reflections afterwards. Joy three times. You think about it, you do it, you think about it afterwards. You get three hits, free of charge. How did you feel then? How do you feel now in remembering? This recollection of generosity gladdens the heart and is the cause for rapture to arise. In remembering skillful actions of both sila and generosity, virtue and generosity, we have the inner sense of and feeling expressed by the Pali word sadhu, which means well done. Sadhu is often said three times after one has performed or witnessed a wholesome action. So this is this section set: forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, generosity. And so again, they're sort of sequential. You know, if we're caught up in anger and not forgiving, it's pretty hard to be generous. And forgiveness in and of itself is a generous act, both to the person being forgiven and to yourself. Gratitude, compassion, generosity. So that's the eight pillars of joy. And I just want to repeat what I said right at the beginning. The interesting thing about these lists is none of them cost 1 cent. This is just there for us to take. All this joy is just there. All we have to do is be aware, wake ourselves up to it. That's all we need to do. I'll finish with a little bit of poetry, of course. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early. And this poem was, that's the first poem in the book, and it's called Why I Wake Early. Hello, sun in my face. Hello, you who make the morning and spread it over the fields and into the faces of the tulips and the nodding morning glories and into the window of even the miserable and crotchety, best preacher that ever was, dear star that just happens to be where you are in the universe to keep us from ever darkness, to ease us with warm touching, to hold us in the great hands of light. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Watch now as I start the day in happiness and kindness. It's a gratitude poem, but leads to starting the day in happiness and kindness.